This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Slate's Audio Book Club. I'm Megan O'Rourke, Slate's culture critic, and joining me today are Troy Patterson, Slate's TV critic and a regular on the Audio Book Club.
Howdy.
Howdy. And a special guest star, Michael Agger, a Slate editor and a columnist, author of the Browser column. Welcome, Michael.
Hello.
So today we are talking about Nicholson Baker's new novel, The Anthologist, which I'm very excited to talk about. But before we get to this very exciting new discussion that we're going to have, Troy is going to bring us a word from our sponsors.
Indeed, and that sponsor is Audible.com, which carries more than 50,000 audiobooks, which you can download right to the same device you have playing at this very moment. And as a special deal for Book Club listeners, if you sign up for a one-book-a-month membership, you'll get a free book as a thank you. You might even choose, the one Nicholson Baker book they have on there is a piece of nonfiction called Human Smoke, which I have not read, but which is apparently this sort of pacifist reconsideration of the lead-up to World War II. It actually didn't get very strong reviews, so maybe you want to skip that one and just read some poems instead.
Although Charles Simic recommends it highly in the latest New York Review of Books, I will just note.
Ah, okay. Noted. Duly noted. So the address to visit, then, is www.audiblepodcast.com/slate. That address, once again, www.audiblepodcast.com/slate. So that's that.
Thank you, Troy, as always. So today, The Anthologist, Nicholson Baker. The Anthologist is a novel that is narrated by Paul Chowder, a middle-aged poet who lives in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and who is trying to finish his work on an anthology. Specifically, he is trying to finish writing an essay about the virtues of rhyme. This isn't no ordinary poetic anthology, but an anthology dedicated to promoting the pleasure and necessity of rhyme in poetry. I'm particularly excited to talk about this book because in addition to being an audiobook club participant, I am a poet and also am a poetry editor at the Paris Review and teach poetry. And this is a kind of whirlwind tour through contemporary poetry in which there are cameos by many of my colleagues. And this is definitely the very first time in an audiobook club I've ever been able to kind of see my colleagues' names in a book. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of a kind of poetry geek's response like mine, I'm very curious, Troy and Michael, what did you make of this book and its portrait of the contemporary American poetry world, and what do you want to say about it?
I quite enjoyed it. I mean, novel's a little bit of a strong word to use for it because it's sort of a voice piece combined with a kind of primer on verse, on meter, most specifically. And like all of the Nicholson Baker novels that I've read, it's very kind of still and deals in what is minute and what is miniature. And I'm thinking most of The Mezzanine, his first novel, which I really dig. And then there's A Box of Matches, which I didn't dig so much, but it's because it's a book about waking up at 4 a.m. and making a fire, which is what it is. So, yeah, I was thoroughly charmed by it. I don't really have any credentials as a poetry person. I got into writing thinking that I wanted to be a poet and then took workshops to that effect in college and then quit that noise by the time I was 19.
Michael, thoughts, impressions, disagreements?
Yeah, well, I hadn't read Baker since the mezzanine, and I don't mean this with any disrespect, but he struck me as very much like David Foster Wallace light, mm-hmm. you know, kind of, again, like the sort of focus on minutia that you were saying, Troy, but, you know, not the sort of level of craziness and much more accessible. And I also, I guess I was really struck by sort of the fundamental, great idea of the books, this character who's defending rhyme. In a previous lifetime, I used to open all the mail for the New Yorker. This was, back before the anthrax scare, but there was still paper mail that was received by magazines.
Magazines.
And there were paper magazines. And this is no exaggeration, two pieces of mail a week always asked for, why don't the poems rhyme anymore? This was like a kind of a sadness. And typically it was clearly like an older reader, older, nice address in Connecticut somewhere. But and then I remember while I was there, we published, the magazine published one John Updike poem that rhymed. And then there was this outpouring of oh, this is the greatest poem you guys have published in, in years. And I salute Baker for, I think, kind of tapping into this weird little intellectual reservoir, this kind of hunger for rhyme. Yeah, that was my impression.
It's interesting bringing up David Foster Wallace. I was thinking about him too. And actually, I just read before coming here Charles Simic's review of this book in the New York Review of Books, which is a pleasurable review to read because, of course, Simic actually comes up in this book a couple of times. So there's a nice kind of mirror effect that I think Baker would appreciate. And actually, Baker talks about Charles Simic's omnibus reviews in the New York Review of Books, and then he's being reviewed. So it's a wonderful, wonderful kind of, and that's part of the pleasure of this book, I think. If you kind of follow the literary periodicals, and one doesn't need to be a poet to do that, but one reads a New York Review of Books, that then you see kind of little mentions that. So this is a book that I think is going to be read with a kind of slightly voracious, just the pleasure of seeing your own world portrayed by a lot of readers. But this book, I think, unlike Wallace, Baker has a real sense of compression and a sense of kind of, he's always interested in what Troy was saying, like the minute and the miniature. And in one of the things that I thought as a poet was most astute in what Baker was saying about poetry, or what this character, Paul Chowder, I should say, is saying about poetry, is he comes up with this idea of the rest at the end of lines. And we'll get into more of what he says about poetry, but one of his great ideas is that, his big idea is that English and American poetry isn't basically based on the iambic pentameter line, which is the line we all learn in grade school and is the line of Shakespeare, to be or not to be, that is the question. But in Chowder's view, it's an older line, the four-beat line, that's the basic building block of English language poetry. And he sort of, this book is in a way a kind of polemic about that. It's sort of musings of an obsessed, lonely guy who wends his way through town and is thinking all the time about the four-beat line, but is a kind of affable, amiable neighbor and kind of, wouldn't give away necessarily his obsessions or his preoccupations. But one of Chowder's ideas is that there's a rest at the end of the line, and that seemed to me so beautiful, and we can look at the examples of it, so beautiful an idea, and also very Baker, because Baker is really interested in pauses and silences. And you think about the mezzanine, that's a book that's sort of about looking at the spaces that get passed by writers, right. Usually.
For anyone who hasn't read it, it's a book about riding up an escalator, rather about the sort of
getting a new shoelace.
It's not quite it's a little bit tidier than a stream of consciousness novel, but it's one that dwells on shoelaces and drinking straws.
I loved this novel. I also thought it was a little bit slight ultimately, and I just wonder what you thought of. I mean, there's sort of two tensions, dramatic tensions in it. One is will Paul Chowder finish his introduction for this anthology, because his editors are calling him. He's not finishing it. He's getting in trouble. And the other is, if he does that, or even apart from doing that, can he get his ex-girlfriend Roz back? He has a girlfriend who's left him. And the kind of main psychic dramas of the book is that he misses her and wants her back. The other is his musings about poetry. Did this feel like satisfying enough to you?
I wouldn't call it slight so much as small, if there's a distinction to be made there. I think it's actually like a novella that happens to be 240 pages. And so it says what it needs to say about its topic, but it's It's minor, but sort of contentedly minor, agreeably minor. Another couple, 3 points I want to make before we charge ahead. One is that despite the certain pleasure that the book will give to people involved in the poetry world, I don't at all want to leave listeners with the impression that there's too much inside baseball here. It's accessible to anyone, or anyone with just even the slightest interest in poems and in poetry. And that, you know, we're talking about the character Paul Chowder, you know, trying to finish his introduction to this anthology. He's not trying that hard. he wishes that he were trying hard, but he's sort of...
He's failing to try hard.
Yeah. And also, there is a way, it's, you know, kind of this... One of these books where there's a guy and he's on the far side of 50 and his girlfriend left him and he's sort of feeling lonely and alone and at loose ends. But it feels a lot fresher and more pleasurable than such a synopsis might indicate. Like, I've certainly had my fill of these kind of ponderous, sort of Richard Ford kind of stories that are just glum and...
There's more to Richard Ford than that.
Clearly, you can see Paul Giamatti playing Paul Chowder in the movie. That's a given. But
you could also see, like, Nick Nolte playing him.
True. Although that would be a scarier.
But not to cut you off. Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, bounce in the language. And so, you know, despite the fact that he dwells on sort of his guilt and... his frustration and his regrets. There's a lot of fun to be had there because he's kind of punchy.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because going along with what you're saying about this not being inside baseball, I was actually at a poetry reading the other night with Charles Simic and we were talking about the book. And one thing I said to him was that I really enjoyed this book. It's very bouncy. It's an investigation of how the mind works, of meandering, of thinking about thinking. And it's about music, actually, quite a lot, too, and about longing and obsession. But in that way, the kind of bounciness makes me not quite convinced that this is really a poet. Like, I think if this were a real poet, I think you'd be far more morose and bitter. And the part of the pleasure of this is that you feel that it's actually kind of Nicholson Baker imagining what it's to be, is to be a poet. And it doesn't, he could be almost anything. He could be a musician. It's the pleasure of watching Baker kind of work out the finger variations of what it might be to be this interested in something,
right?
Almost.
Yeah, I thought Paul Chowder was, like, a fairly excellent, like, New England curmudgeon. Like, you definitely wanted to spend time with him. Like, I enjoyed his taste in beer, like Newcastle brown ale, and he also liked smuttiness. I thought, you know, Baker has this sort of wonderful specificity to, you know, rural orneriness, I guess. It's funny, we keep talking about how the, you know, real poets are mentioned, and, you know, this book kind of tries to limb the world of poetry, and I think, I don't know, I sort of got the impression that Baker was doing that to kind of convey a bigger point of the book, is just the, you know, the kind of fundamental humanness of poetry, you know, so that's sort of what all the kind of naming of names, and, you know, I'm sending my poems to Paul Muldoon at the New Yorker, and good old Alice Quinn, and then, I don't know, I was wondering what your impressions of why he was so specific about that world, you know, what did you think of that?
It's a good question, because there's a lot also in the book. Like, he does a beautiful reading of a W.H. Auden poem, and he does some readings of poems, and he offers up this whole kind of primer, as Troy was saying, on what meter is, but in a very playful way, kind of in the way that one might, if, you know, it's sort of like the dream elementary school teacher who would make this all really interesting, alive, kind of funny.
Yeah, it's anti-pedantic.
Anti-pedantic. And in fact, one of his things is that he keeps being like, why do they talk about things like pentameter and tetrameter? Why are the words this bad? And he turns it into music. He turns it into song, and which is really pleasurable. I don't know. I asked myself that question, why the specificity of these names? Because it becomes almost a little distracting at times. It was pleasurable for me, but it wasn't... I think your answer that there's something about kind of demystifying the world, turning it into a world of real people working. And one of the themes of the book and one of the things he investigates is this idea of what does it mean to be a poet, and the idea of suffering, the idea that, like, the real poets suffered tremendously and suffered these, you know, extreme depressions, and that, you know, being on Prozac and having a little bit of melancholy like he does doesn't quite qualify as the true suffering of the poets. And so I think that's part of it, too, is sort of looking at the way that poetry has become professionalized in this country and just holding that up. I don't know. Troy, what did you think?
We're talking still about sort of the appearance of real people in this book.
Yeah, Michael was asking why did we.
I suppose that I think that might be among the flaws of the book. I suppose it does do something to kind of ground the book in reality, and it does do something to convey the status anxiety of Paul Chowder as someone who, you know, has enjoyed some success, and years ago he won a Guggenheim and he's been invited to teach and he gets invited to conferences, but, you know, his best years are behind him and he feels like he's going nowhere. And he's certainly not producing anything new. So, you know, comparing himself against his peers and talking about the editors who would write him very kind rejection notes conveys his that kind of worry a bit. I also did find a bit persuasive, you know, our friend David Orr, who is a poetry critic, reviewed this for The Times and made a pretty persuasive case that there's something that's a bit off-key about how real people appear here, as if there's a scene later in the book where Paul Muldoon turns up at this poetry conference in Switzerland and, you know, people are freaking out about his appearance like teeny boppers outside the Paramount screaming for Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. Definitely there is something off-key about it. There's also something a little off-key about, I thought, about this person's taste, the kind of constellation of poets that he loves the most, and actually even the lines he chooses to represent what he thinks is so great about four-beat poetry often seem to me not the most exemplary lines of four-beat, you know, they're not the most beautiful lines of poetry. And it did raise for me a question of how much does Baker care? Because there's also a lot of moments where he's explaining some moment of poetic history, and he's being completely tongue-in-cheek and not telling you what actually... I mean, for example, he talks about enjambment, and he says the word, which is when you break a line, and it has a kind of radical break. So if you break the line after the word the, and the next word is the fruit. Like, I gave the dog the line break fruit. That would be, you know, an enjambment and heart. And he says it's because it's where you throw ham to the dog. Or, you know, he has this kind of completely preposterous explanation. Then he's like, no, just kidding. It's because you're jamming forward. And you're like, neither of those things are true at all. So there's a kind of a lightness, a tongue-in-cheek quality here. And I didn't know how much of that, like, how deeply that extends through the book. That was one question I have, is like a lot of this kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke. Or are some of the lines that he chooses supposed to be, like, how much do we identify Baker with Paul Chowder and Baker's beliefs with Paul Chowder's beliefs, and how much do we see a distance between the two?
I have to say that the book sold me on its main mission. Like, you know, I definitely came away wanting to read poetry. There's sort of this nice little, one of the many nice little riffs in the book is like, you know, there's like only a couple times in your life where you sort of intensely care about poetry. And Chowder identifies one of them as sort of, you know, the age of 19. And then we never really get the other stages. But, you know, I wonder, I just felt like, you know, while the book was playing around with the idea of, you know, failure, it was also trying to do this, you know, sneaky thing of coming around the corner and making you really want to have one of these intense poetry moments again in your life. Because it's sort of, you know, it's like kind of the opposite. Poetry is sort of the opposite of everything that's happening right now. You know, you're paying attention to compression and language, and it's kind of hard to find, you know. And I don't know. I guess it seems like I was more taken with the... I don't know, the book managed to pick my pocket a little bit that way.
One thing I was thinking about, and I'm trying to find a quote, too, that we could look at, but I was thinking about the book is also, and I wonder if you guys thought this, a kind of meditation on what it is to be a writer and what it is to... Where I saw Baker in the book is this question of what does it mean to be a writer? What is this work in a culture that's being increasingly given over to television and movies and technology, you know, what does it mean to write novels or poems? And it felt like Baker didn't want to write a book about being a novelist, so he wrote a book about being a poet, which might be unfair. But there were moments where I felt that and kind of enjoyed that a little bit. One of the moments that really struck home for me was when he talks about the fact that Chowder is meditating on the future. You know, anthropologists are going to dig up American culture and they're going to say, you know, they're going to be fascinated by the sitcom because that's going to be the new, you know, the form that emerged in this time, which is true. And they're going to say things like, we don't know much about the originators of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but we believe that, you know, they were big, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought that there was something kind of quite poignant and quite like that this was quite a middle-aged novel, but not in the lumbering way that that Troy mentioned before, that I agree that there's a kind of bounciness. And part of it is just the descriptions. Maybe I could read a little description on page 65 that are very typically Baker. He's kind of, you know, he kind of anatomizes procrastination beautifully. So he says, I packed 4 boxes of papers in my office and I threw out lots of things. This cleaning is helping me move forward. I put the chin-up bar in the door and hit my head on it twice because I forgot it was there. Then I took it down and put it in another door. I think if I really cleaned up my office, it might be easier for me to finish the introduction. And if I finish the introduction, I think I could call Roz with genuine confidence in my voice and tell her that, yes, I'd been too much of a wallower in self-doubt, but that things were on the mend and I wanted her to come back. I'm about 1/7 done with cleaning the office. Still quite a ways to go. One corner of the room is starting to get that spare, empty look. I do love that look. You know, and that's a very typical of this voice. And it's sort of funny because in a way he actually doesn't seem too much of a wallower. He's a wallower who goes up into his barn where he writes and he sings rather than descend into the true gloom and despair that probably many writers are descending into up there.
Yeah, and again, that's the... it's sort of his whimsical nature and his sort of sense of play that I think both says something about how writing works or how writing should work, and also keeps the character interesting. I would say that, that Nicholson Baker and Paul Chowder are at a healthy distance.
Yeah, I agree.
But perhaps they're both interested, on top of sort of their interest in poetry, I think that they're both interested in sort of sound and noise. There's a good riff about sort of baby talk in here.
Yeah.
And then there are these...
And syllables, where syllables begin. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. About syllables. And there are a lot of fun sort of obscure words and neologisms and sort of surprising bits of speech. He writes about Elizabeth Bishop's up-floofing hair.
I love that. Yeah. Absolutely fabulous. He also, one I just happened to turn to, is he's talking about these federal buildings, and he talks about the federal security corn slab ectochrome mediocrity desk as an outpost of American impotence.
But, I mean, Megan, I think you're right that, you know, the book is chock full of writing advice, and I took out some of them. I mean, you know, at one point he quotes Auden about how you should write drunk and revise sober. Like, I'm wondering what you guys thought of that advice.
Certainly worth trying.
I follow it about once a week.
And then there was sort of, we've heard this before, but he has this sort of riff against teaching, this, you know, saying that to teach is to sort of be a professional liar because you have to tell students, you know, week in and week out that, you know, these poems are, that they're writing are worthy of attention when in fact they're not. And I don't know, I guess that was one of the points in the book that I thought was a little ungenerous. It just seems like, you know, Chowder is kind of open to the world. He's trying to maintain a certain window of innocence, and then to kind of have this, I don't know, cynicism towards teaching kind of really surprised me. But how did that strike you guys?
Yeah. It seemed like I felt like I totally understood that as a poetic, you know, as a type of character in the writing world, that so many, there is that kind of character who's like, oh, I don't teach, you know, that would involve being a lie. And they sort of put on slightly superior airs about the fact that they don't teach. And so in that sense, I bought it as part of Chowder's character, and I also thought it set up the book, which is that he doesn't want to teach, but he actually is a teacher, and this whole book is a form of teaching, and he wants to communicate, and there's a kind of pleasurable little paradox there. So in a way, I took it as being less totally cynical, less cynical a moment, and more kind of like part of his lack of self-knowledge and part of his just kind of general haplessness that he couldn't really get it together to teach. But that might be a misreading of my part.
For teachers out there, Paul Chowder did invent the mark UR, which means unread.
that was my favorite idea. I was wondering if we could try that.
I, you know, did, try this at, you know, results may vary, mileage may vary, try that, don't try that at home or, you know, what have you. But
but going back to Troy's point too about the kind of pleasures of language, one of the things that makes this enjoyable, I think, is just those little moments. And one for me was when he describes the fact that he, you know, this is a portrait of a curmudgeon, but a jovial curmudgeon, and that's part of what makes him distinctive, is that the joviality that goes hand in hand with the, you know, what could otherwise be pedantry, but just becomes kind of lighthearted obsession. And so, for example, he desperately wants all poems to rhyme, and actually, this book did make me think, God, why don't poets rhyme as much as they do? Even though I also think that singular obsession with rhyme is a little peculiar, but he describes at one point the fact that he only considers poems that rhyme to be poems. Poems that don't rhyme, he calls plums, which is very funny.
Yeah. And which would make you a plumber. Right?
Yes, exactly.
or a plumette.
Yeah. But I wonder if someone might read a passage that, if we might find a passage that we thought kind of epitomizes his ability to be enjoyable about poetry rather than pedantic. I don't know. Did you, either of you, have a favorite passage?
What I was just looking at, this is less about the sort of the scansion that he does, and then this goes towards the fun way he expresses himself. He's talking about the fact that, you know, in order to be a great poet, you only have to write, like, 3 or 4 great poems in a lifetime. Like, you know, as with any other endeavor, most of what you do is going to be, if not dross exactly, then sort of the middling work, which I suppose in many cases of what you have to work through in order to get to the great poems. And here from page 102 is a fun bit about that that also reminded me in its way of this Allen Ginsberg poem, Supermarket in California. Tennyson's at the salad bar, making his way around, holding the chilled plastic plate, fumbling in his beard, poet laureate of the British Empire, staring for a long time at the tub of bean salad. Corn salad or bean salad, which will it be today? Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Plop, beans. Pope's there. Alexander Pope, the magpie, trickster, rock polisher, malevolently ladling the blue cheese at eye level, taking care not to spill. Hey, Alex, you don't want to talk to me? That's fine. And what each of them comes up with is a couple of pages worth of poems in an anthology. All of that rhythmic chewing and swallowing and digesting, all the conversational nodding, yes, yes, true, true. Mm-hmm. Results in something called collected poems, and out of these collected poems grow a few sprouts, a couple of pages, and a paperback. That's the way it works. Long ago, there was an article in Commentary. The article was called Why We Need More Waste, Fraud, and Mismanagement in the Pentagon. The idea was that in order to build a magnificent weapon of deterrence, you need to tolerate $20 screws and $500 screwdrivers. Well, it's not really true of the Pentagon, but it's true of poetry. I suppose at this point I want to back up and explain that the first paragraph about the salad bar has to do with another theory of Paul Chowder's that making a poem is kind of like making a salad. And, you know, you want some red onions in there and maybe some gorgonzola.
And it's just, I think, I was thinking about this as you were reading, that, you know, a big part of this book and of Baker's work more broadly is the kind of reinforcement of the pleasure of imagination, that, you know, that this guy, what keeps him from being a wallower, he uses the word wallower to describe himself, you know, but he's always imagining, that he can't focus on his anthology essay because he's just a procrastinator. He's interested in other things. He wants to set poems to tunes. He's actually somewhat happy up there avoiding. And it's not pure happiness because there's obviously some anxiety this thread of darkness running through the book about what have I really accomplished. But the book actually, I thought, came to a very kind of calm place about that, a place of acceptance of we write, what, you know, which is actually connected to the riff that you just read, which is we write. You know, one of the things that Chowder really wants to do but hasn't yet is he wants to write that really great poem, the poem that will be his anthology poem, and he believes he has not, and he talks about kind of creating the circumstances in which to do it, that he would do anything in order to write that poem, and that he spends a lot of time striving to write the poem, but he hasn't. And yet the book doesn't end on a very dark note about that, it seemed to me. How did you read that strain of the book, Michael?
Yeah, it seems... You know, interesting, like connecting to my riff before about how the Chowder character is anti-teaching, you know, You're right that he never does write the poem, but the book does end in a sort of ecstatic moment when he's teaching a conference, and Chowder, you know, gives his one big piece of writing advice, which is that you know, when you start a poem, you should, you know, try to remember the best thing about the day. So yeah, I guess there is a sort of, you know, sense that you may not write great poetry, but you can kind of fall back into the community of poetry or you know, people who care about language, and then the people who care about you. There seems to be a suggestion that can sustain you, whereas, you know, the creative work, if it's not of the highest level, or it's not going to be immortal, or, you know, live as long as the language is alive, or something.
Right, it's preoccupation, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because it is upbeat that way. It, you know, you get the sense that everyone will survive, or Chowder will survive, I guess. Yeah,
because I kept wondering how he was going to get out of this, because I was like, is Roz really going to come back? Is he going to finish the essay and Roz will come back and everything will be great? Mm-hmm. And he cut, basically, that is kind of what happens, right? Mm-hmm. We can talk about the end for a moment. Spoiler alert, I suppose, for our readers who haven't gotten to it. You know, he ends up writing the introduction. Well, actually, this conference is key. It's kind of the catalyst moment, right? He is confronted with all of these students who are, you know, are eager for his pearls of wisdom gleaned from years of being a writer. And that's part of this book, too, is he starts with there's a kind of a slight archness to the tone about knowledge and delivering knowledge onto others. And if I just quote very quickly from the beginning, the first paragraph is, "Hello, this is Paul Chowder, and I'm going to try to tell you everything I know. Well, not everything I know, because a lot of what I know, you know. But everything I know about poetry, all my tips and tricks and woes and worries are going to come tumbling out before you. I'm going to divulge them." What a juicy word that is, divulge. Truth opening its petals. Truth smells like Chinese food and sweat. So there's a kind of archness, I think, a kind of both a kind of sense of pleasure and a sense of archness. And at the very end, that comes back as a kind of parenthesis where he's at this conference, he's supposed to be delivering wisdom, and then he finally says, he just comes at that very natural truth of the thing you should write about is the thing that was the best thing in your day, which does actually seem quite Baker-esque to me. And then, of course, he bursts into tears in front of his students. And that's the transitional moment after which he goes home, writes his introduction, and sort of tries to get Roz back. How did that strike you? Troy, how did that strike you as a device? It's a little bit of the deus ex machina of the novel.
Yeah, it's a little bit in a novel that's otherwise very kind of understated and measured. It might be kind of a touch operatic. I mean, I guess the Paul was overdue for some kind of catharsis or minor breakdown or whatever you want to call it. It's interesting, you know, I just read this book last week, but I'd kind of sort of forgotten that was the ending of it. The impression that I was left with, I fixed on kind of a scene where he's like helping a friend do some house painting.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, my impression was that he's, in my memory, it's that he kind of made peace with his limitations and with his failures and was in a New England kind of way sort of discovering the pleasure of sort of a simple work.
Soulcraft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is, you know, a worked over theme in itself. But
right.
That's, you know, the greatest joys he gets in this book beyond kind of reading and beyond his pleasure in reading and communicating that pleasure in others. He's having the most fun when he's like mowing his neighbor's lawn or helping her lay down a new wood floor or picking blueberries.
Yeah. And those go hand in hand with what my favorite moments about poetry in the book were, which is not really have anything to do with the inside poetry world part of it at all, but more just that, again, that kind of obsessive attention to just the small things of life, the mundane pleasures and the things one's mind get hooks on that otherwise often don't get written about. And that is one of the things that Baker has made a career out of. And so there's the kind of what it's like. He has a whole meditation on nailing and the rhythm of hammering something into the floor, which is wonderful. And that, to me, is quite analogous. He also has a very funny little meditation on how when he reads 19th century or older poetry that has you know, little elision. So it'll say something like, you know, the misty fog rolls o'er the hills, you know, O apostrophe E-R. He's like, I can't stand that. So I read the V, but you have to read it very quickly and kind of quietly and silently so it's not quite a syllable. And those are the moments that for me really were the most winning and anchoring parts of this novel. Whereas actually I think I would tend to agree with David Orr that some of the stuff that's sort of fun to read about the contemporary poetry world didn't really say very much about it, ultimately.
Yeah. And slightly connecting to this, I think we should discuss the kind of the two most amazing corrections in the book, which is, I'll just read it.
Number?
Yeah, page 126. And so it says, "You can take it a step further and say, as Herrick did, gather ye rosebuds. Go ahead, say it if you must. But no, it was a typo. It was supposed to be gather your rosebuds. The ye was an abbreviation for your, but with an E in the place of the R. It was corrected to your in the second edition. So yes, you can say, enjoy the panoply now, friends. Gather your rosebuds. Make the best bouquet of them you can manage. Use all the sprigs of baby's breaths you care to use, because time is on the march, and you must, of course, seize the day. But here's the thing. Horace didn't say that. Carpe diem doesn't mean seize the day. It means something gentler and more sensible. Carpe diem means pluck the day. Carpe, pluck. Seize the day would be cape diem, if my school Latin serves. No R. Very different piece of advice. What Horace had in mind was that you should gently pull on the day's stem, as it were, say, a wildflower or an olive, holding it with all the practiced care of your thumb and the side of your finger, which knows how to not crush easily crushed things, so that the day's stalk or stem undergoes increasing tension and draws to a thinness and a tightness and then snaps softly away at its weakest point. The sentence goes on, perhaps leaking a little milky sap, and the flower or the fruit is released in your hand." I thought that was a really...
Next line, too. Pluck the cranberry or blueberry of the day tenderly for you without damaging it, is what Horace meant.
My favorite sentence in this passage comes further along yet. Don't freaking grab the day in your fist like a burger at a fairground and take a big chomping bite out of it.
That's not the kind of
man that Horace was.
But this is a really fabulous passage, and it totally is great because it also captures his character. I mean, that's such a New England-y character, like the kind of, you know, jovial guy who, you know, is obsessed with things and suddenly kind of lets this little burst of anger out about kind of something about contemporary culture, which that line of don't freaking grab the day in your fist like a burger, you know, that's one of those moments of small anger. I was wondering, having had several other kind of discursive passages like this where he's telling you something that is just not true, I was wondering, I meant to look up I was trying to recall my own high school Latin, and I could not remember, is seize the day really cape diem? You know, how much of this was true? I couldn't quite remember.
We need Google in the audio book.
I should have just looked it up before. Yeah. But it's a totally amazing passage, whichever the key, you know, however he's, whether it's his own rereading of it or whether it's, you know, an accurate reading.
And I think it gets at what we were talking about, this sort of like, you know, this kind of love of dailiness and trying to notice the kind of the details.
What do you think it is, Megan, that poems stopped rhyming? Paul Chowder, you know, has this sort of whole proposition that's, you know, somewhat convincing about how it has to do with Poe's being translated into the French.
It depends on who you talk to. Convincing.
It makes just enough, even if he's a crank, it makes just enough sense to be, to seem worthy of consideration.
Yes, we should say what that is, what his theory is. Troy, do you want to take a stab at it? He has a theory about why poems stop writing.
Well, he blames it on the futurists.
He blames it on, right, Marinetti's Futurist Manifesto.
And he kind of blames it on Swinburne, too, right? So right. Swinburne was this massively prolific poet, and he seems to have exhausted the language. He was sort of this natural, the ice cube of his day, and kind of this natural genius for rhyme. And after that,
rhymed so
poetry
much
was exhausted. Right. Yeah, there was just no...
Yeah. And then I guess after Marinetti's...
Sort of Marinetti infected Ezra Pound with this sort of idea, which is not unconnected to fascism, and that, Ezra Pound in his sort of patriarchal way dispensed it to his peers and his youngers while distributing cheese doodles at salons.
This is, to me, a very, you know, a crank theory. You know, it has some basis in, you know, yes, you can say that, you know, Swinburne is exemplary of a kind of, you know, something that happened with rhyme and the kind of exhaustion of rhyme. I don't think it's that, you know, Elizabeth Bishop read, you know, or Ezra Pound read Swinburne, or, you know, Eliot read Swinburne and then said, I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I think more broadly, it is part of this broader cultural shift that was happening. And he just chooses these particular kind of people and manifestos to kind of hang his theory on, almost like one would hang the tablecloth over the clothesline that he talks about so much. But, you know, to me, it does have to do with something he gets at, which is that idea of the exhaustion of language a little bit. And obviously, I think, to me, the disappearance of rhyme also has to do with, you know, free verse was introduced in English language poetry as a corrective to what someone like Pound perceived as the kind of falseness of iambic pentameter, which is something actually paradoxically that Chowder might agree with. That, you know, Pound was excited about free verse because he saw it as an opportunity for people to stop padding their lines, that there was all this kind of extra language in poetry that was just decorative, ornamental, false. And it was because of meter, right, that people didn't know how, you know, they had to fill this pre-existing form and that was not authentic. And this is all happening as the world is changing. And he saw free verse as an attempt to kind of get back to, not so much just to let anyone do whatever and not have a musicality to the poetry, but actually to intensify the musicality of the poetry and perhaps even rhyme. So I've lost my train of thought. But it does seem, you know, that it's part of this sense of an exhaustion of the language and of a desire to kind of get back to an authentic language, you know, Wordsworth's idea of men speaking to men. And rhyme in English in particular is extremely dependent on inversion. And inversion, you know, so the idea, so that inverting words in their order, which sounds extremely false to us. And so I think that's part of it, too, that rhyme got more difficult for poets, so they sort of start to let go of it a little bit. But I don't know. What do you think? Do you have a theory?
Of why poems stopped rhyming? You know, I think that what you have to say is persuasive. What Paul Chowder has to say is not entirely unpersuasive, right? Because it's no fun to have sort of a protagonist or a first-person narrator who's just a total dingbat.
Crank is a good word, because cranks might have something, right? You know, they're sort of like conspiracy theorists. He reminds me a little of a conspiracy theorist. Conspiracy theorists usually are kind of right in some way, but they're like putting all the weight on certain things,
right,
certain very specific things. When you think, well, what about X and Y and Z?
Right.
Right. Is it really Marinetti, or is it like broadly speaking a number of things that are happening in the culture?
Right.
You know, if like Marinetti's essay hadn't been written, would we all be writing poems that rhyme? You know,
I like the notion that, you know, that Chowder suggests that, you know, the kind of desire for lyric poetry has been, you know, kind of plowed into hip hop. I thought that was sort of an interesting notion.
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And I actually had this amazing moment. I had just read that scene and I was on the subway on my way to Princeton to teach my intro to poetry to my students. And there was this guy, this young guy sitting there writing lyrics to a hip hop song. And he was so physical and so intensely kind of reading out loud to himself. Everyone in the car just started to look at him because he was so in it, and it was this, he was moving and his hands were moving and his body was moving and it had this intense musicality. And I was like, that's what it was to be a poet once upon a time. I mean, that is what, you know, if you see like the bright Star, the new movie about Keats, he and Charles Brown are always reading their poems out loud. And of course, it's a dramatization and it has to be in a movie, but there was that sense of like the musicality, the physicality of it. And
yeah, Keats had mad flow. You would
say mad flow.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I suddenly thought, oh God, what has happened? We don't rhyme. We don't do anything. It is just slow prose. Isn't that what he calls it?
You know, rhyming has its downsides. As, you know, any poetry slam refugee will tell you.
what I don't agree with is his so yes, I can kind of accept, in a way, I don't mean to say that Chowder is a dingbat, I do sort of accept certain parts of his story about how rhyme, but what I can't get down with is his assertion that the four-beat line is the line of English poetry. Like, to me, that I totally enjoyed that as a proposition, as a kind of polemical proposition for the book, and I think the book wouldn't have worked without it, and it made me reconsider the four-beat line. But I wouldn't want the four-beat line to be the sole building block.
Sure. It's still something to chew on. And
totally.
And what is the most rewarding thing about the book is that it does sort of inspire one, or at least inspire me, to read poetry and reread poetry. And so on that note, I think I'm going to go look into some Louise Bogan right now.
Oh, yeah. She's pretty great. I totally agree. And it made me, you know, I'm in the middle of thinking through these two workshops I'm teaching, and it did actually make me think about them differently and to think about the four-beat line and the importance of really, I mean, he's right. That is a totally crucial, part of English language poetry, that we tend to privilege the iambic pentameter, the kind of refocusing our attention on that. I have to say I enjoyed that. I went back to a lot of those poems. I enjoyed chewing over a lot of his different propositions about, you know.
Did you do any singing? You know, the book asked you to do a lot of singing.
No. I don't sing. Although it did remind me, and I was hoping he would have this in there, and he didn't, that in college, a college professor of mine once, who was teaching me Milton, noted, offhandedly, that you could sing the opening of Paradise Lost to the tune of the Flintstones. And I have never been able to read it the same way again.
Would
the
you
opening
share some
of, that? Yes, of man's disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. I can't, I'm totally off key, but you get the picture. The line is of man's disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. And you can totally do the, I can't remember the tune of the Flintstones
we
exactly.
We could do a whole podcast on fun facts from college. For example, I know that Ulysses starts with the letter. It starts with a word that begins with S and ends with Y, and then ends with a word that starts with Y and begins with S.
Ah,
that's pretty much
that's
all I can
one.
Tell you about Ulysses.
Michael, what did you take away from the book?
Yeah, I mean, I, like Troy, wanted to go, read some poems and, maybe out in public on the subway. It kind
yeah.
of like,
yeah.
you know, three cheers for poetry again. And, it kind of made me never wanted to live in like a converted barn
yeah.
in the middle of the woods either. You know, I think like Chatter, I would grow to hate the bird song, and I don't know. So I just, read poetry in a reasonably quiet apartment somewhere. I think that's the lesson of the Anthologist.
Yes, yeah. absolutely. Well, on that note, I think we will bring this podcast to a close. We hope that you will join us next time when we're going to be discussing different versions of Raymond Carver stories, A Small Good Thing and The Bath, and the sort of Gordon Lish, his editor's version, and his own version, and maybe broadly a little bit more of Carver and those differences. Michael and Troy, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
For Slate.com, I'm Megan O'Rourke.